First, I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing this nice conference and also for inviting me to give a talk. Since I don't attend conferences very regularly, I have a lot of things to talk about. But thanks to Mina, she has covered some of these things, so I will actually concentrate on some of theirs. It's lucky to have so many smart collaborators, and I'm very glad to be working with them. But I'm going to be concentrating only on mainly on these three works related to the work we've already done with Cachazzo and Intelligator, and two works which are to appear with Cachazzo and Katz, and also Cachazzo Fiol, Intelligator and Katz. So this is a summary of some aspects of what Mina talked about and some in the overlap with the talk I'm giving. So where should I start? Let's start with the number two there. So in that context, we study type 2A strings in a conifold geometry, wrap n d6 plane around this tree. And there's a large n dual motivated from the Chern-Simons duality with Rajesh, and also embedding in type 2A string suggests an S2 grows. This can be lifted up to M theory, giving a smooth transition, a transition involving smooth in the quantum sense, of manifolds involving G2 holonomy based on these works. And that's a lift of this geometry. And you can also do mirror symmetry in going to type 2B and wrap in the five brains, and again the mirror of this will be the corresponding mirror flux. This latter one is related to a work of Klebanov and Strassler, and also Madassina and Nunes. And there's also the 2' prime and 3' prime versions, which is what Mina also talked about. That's where instead of this geometry, we had not a compact brain, but a non-compact brain, which had exactly equivalent to this description by an S-duality of M-theory. And its mirror, which is the mirror computation that Mina talked about in the B-model context. So you have two of these versions as well by some S-duality map, which she did discuss. So these are all of these different viewpoints are good for something. Depends on what the question is. For example, this can be viewed as construction of the theory in string theory. This can be viewed as M-theory explanation of the duality. And this is a context in which the computations are easier in the type 2B mirror. And similarly here, there's yet another description which actually makes the transition even more trivial. So in some sense, the talk that Mina gave would be a way to actually sum up M2 brain instantons in a effective way using string theory perturbation. So this, as far as the computability power is of these class of models, the simplest one is the one related to the talk that Mina gave. But I'm going to concentrate, I forgot to say, on this latter one, because I'm going to try to compute these using classical computations on the mirror in a different way. And all of these involve dualities as geometric transitions. So we have brains wrapped around some cycles, for example, the Q-sphere. And the boundary of the geometry typically is something like a product of two spheres. And by the time we go to transition, these brains have disappeared, leaving off fluxes. You see the geometrically actually quite nicely matches. These arrows come from these brains. These are the corresponding leftover fluxes from the corresponding brains. This description not only fits with these kind of dualities, but also on more general ADS-CFT dualities also can be viewed as such a transition. So I'm trying to emphasize this aspect of dualities in terms of geometric transition, but in particular in the context of this third class. So the class of theories I'm going to consider are n equals to 1 AD quiver theories. These theories will be theories with matter content of product of the unitary groups in one-to-one correspondence with the nodes of the Dynkin diagram. We can put labels by the nodes, which correspond to the rank of the group. In addition, there are bifundamentals. Qij in one-to-one correspondence with these lines in the Dinkin diagram. And each gauge group will have an adjoint field. So the matter content actually is an n equal to 2 matter content, because this can be made an n equal to 2. And these bifundamentals arrange as hypermultiplets with bifundamental representations between the corresponding nodes. We can do this for the ADE as well as for the affine versions, and I will talk about both of them. But they will also allow arbitrary subpotentials for all of them. So allow arbitrary subpotential for arbitrary nodes, so it's a very general class of theories. The first step is the construction of these theories. The second step is the large and dual. Well, construction is motivated by the ADE in the description. So we start with the ADE kind of singularity. So this is C2 mod gamma, where gamma is a discrete subgroup of SU2. This is a familiar map, so I don't have to explain too much. The cyclic group corresponds to the AN singularity, AN minus 1 singularity. And similarly for the other ones, DN, E6, E7, and E8. The local geometry can be described by this singularity of this in terms of three complex variables with this relation. We can deform the singularity in this way. This is familiar also. So let me talk about the AN case, for example, AN minus 1 case. It looks like this. And these TI could be viewed as a holomorphic volume, the integral of the holomorphic 2 form about some particular 2 cycles in this geometry. So these parameterize some holomorphic integrals. And I will choose coordinates, TI, such that it's exactly given by the integral of the holomorphic 2 form of the Calabi-Yau integrated over a corresponding 2 cycle. So with some appropriate basis of 2 cycles, this corresponds to the some neighboring t's. It corresponds to the holomorphic integral of the holomorphic 2 form over the ith cycle is the difference between two adjacent t's. In addition to these complex deformations, there are also Kähler deformations. Actually, in the ADE setup, the Kähler and complex mix up because of the higher supersymmetry. But since I'm going to fiber this story in a second, I want to distinguish Kähler and complex deformations. So the Kähler deformations could be viewed as blowing up further, which is an extra parameter, and the B field would be complexifying that. So it would be two additional parameters in the typical string theory complex setup. But here I'm only exhibiting the complex deformations. This can be done for the D and the E series as well. The TI I'm going to identify, so I choose a deformation and parameterize it in terms of holomorphic volumes. I can always do that. So when I write F of X, Y, Z, and TI, I mean just this most general deformation. So consider Calabi-Yau threefold geometry, where we fiber this geometry, AD kind of geometry, over some other geometry plane. So we take TI to be a function of another complex parameter, some dependence. So this would be a function of four variables with some relation, so it's a threefold. In fact, this way of obtaining threefolds has been considered even before these duality revolutions by mathematicians. Morrison and Katz studied this kind of context, where it was natural for the construction of the threefold flops to consider ADE kind of geometries fibered over plane. So here I'm drawing the A2 case. The A2 case here is just you have two of these P1s, and as a function of the T's, these two cycles are changing shape. The holomorphic integral of the two form varies as you vary the corresponding t's, depending on what the t's are. So depending on what these functions are as a function of t, at each point in t, you have different sizes, or different holomorphic sizes more precisely, for these P1s. So consider type 2B string theory in this background. Wrap NID5 brains around the S2i, the ith 2 sphere. This leads to an n equals to 1 gauge theory with this matter quantum that I just told you before. Well, why is it like this? Well, that part is kind of obvious. It relates to the fact that it underlying there's a K3 or an ADE geometry, which has n equal to 4 supersymmetry. Wrapping brains around it reduces to an n equal to 2 multiplet. That's what it is. And the intersection of the brains will tell you what the matter is, so that's where that comes from. So that's not surprising. We already knew this. So this part, if you write the superpotential, this part we already knew, base of n equal to 2. The question is how to get arbitrary superpotential. And that turns out to be surprisingly easy. You just identify the Ti as a function of T with the derivative of the ith superpotential. That's a map between the superpotential. This is the critical formula here. This is the gradient of the superpotential is the corresponding parameter Ti. You can actually show this, but I won't show it here. It's not difficult to see it. For example, if you're interested in constructing a theory which has a superpotential for the ith node, for the ith potential in this form, you have to take Ti fibered over T in this way. Yes? Each phi I, so this, I should have put a no I label on this phi so that there's no confusion. The derivative of the ith potential only depends on the ith field, so that's given. But just write as di of the ith superpotential as a function of phi is the same functional dependence as ti as a function of t. So there's only one t appearing in this formula, not many ti. Notation is a bit confusing because the description is a bit strange. It's strange that the answer comes out this simple. So I should not put an I label here, where you identify phi with T. Sorry? Remember, we have many gauge groups. For each node, we have a gauge group. Each one has an adjoint field, and I can consider independent superpotential for each one of them, trace of some polynomial in that phi. Yes?
It could happen some phi maps.
Yes, yes. I'll come to the example. I want to be general at this point. Before I do it, I want to say something about the alpha inversion. Here I was considering the geometric orbifold, C2 mod gamma, but I could have considered string orbifold, that's what we're string theorists. So in fact, this was done by Douglas and Moore. The setup changed the quiver to an affine quiver. That's the only difference. And what is the difference between this and what I was talking about in terms of complex geometry? None. The deformation is a Kähler deformation, so it does not affect the equations I'm writing. It affects the actual manifold, the metric and so forth, but not the complex equation which I'm writing at this stage. So at this stage, I could as well be talking about the affine case. Depends on what B field we take, and that's the only difference. So I can interpret this equation, this geometry, with some particular choice of Kähler deformations as a string orbifold, which then would be the affine. In that case, there's an extra node. The affine Dinkin diagram has one extra node, and I can put some number of brains there. As is well known, that corresponds to the D3 brain charge in the story. The extra brain that you can add is that, in particular, if you put N3D3 brains, the gauge group will look like U of the Dinkin indices of affine Dinkin diagram times N3, plus some MI, which depends on how many fire brains I'm wrapping around the other cycles. So that would be the general class of gauge theories I get. So I can think of it as a general affine ADE U and I product over them with one constraint. I cannot get arbitrary superpotential, but I can get superpotential satisfying this relation. This just follows from the fact that the D2 brain charge of this is zero, this combination. This is the relation of the extended node with the other nodes in terms of the holomorphic volumes. This will translate to a condition about the superpotential. So I will consider on the n equals to 1 ADE quiver theories, affine ones, subject to arbitrary superpotentials, subject to one linear relation between superpotentials. So this is the most general class I said, except for one relation among the R plus 1 superpotentials, given by Dynkin indices. Okay, so when I write from now on F of this equal to 0 plus some number of defined rings, I'm talking about, I'm geometrically engineering a gauge theory N equals to 1 of Coover type, and I could be talking about ordinary or diaphane case, depending on what the Kähler deformations are. So at this level, I'm not distinguishing them, and I will talk about both. So I'll give you two examples which have actually already been studied in this category. The A1 example of this has already been studied by Kachru, Katz, Lawrence, and McGreevy. And that's just as an illustration, is a good example. You take T1, it's an A1 singularity. You take a T1, which is a deformation of A1, and you identify with a gradient of superpotential. So that's the geometric engineering of an N equals to 1, UN, with one adjoint field with a superpotential W. The A1 hat version of this is a case where the two W's are opposite in sign. A special case of this is when W is phi squared. The next example of this category was studied by Gubser, Nekrasov, and Shatashvili. That was also, they studied the whole affine ADE case as well. The case they studied was quadratic potentials for the W's. That corresponds to setting Ti to be linear in T, all of them, with some coefficients Mi, with some constraint again, the constraint I mentioned. So the example, the general formulation I gave you generalizes both of these into the most general form of this kind. Okay, this was the construction part. So now the gauge theory analysis. So let me not be too general at this stage. I'll confuse you otherwise. Let's just take a very simple example, A1. The A1 case means we have an N equals to 1 UN gauge theory with an adjoint field, and I'm allowing an arbitrary superpotential. If you take a more generic superpotential, then the gradient of these are isolated. The gradient of W being 0 are isolated vacua. And I can put phi, a certain number of the phi eigenvalues into the first vacuum, the second one, and so forth, depending on how I break it. It gives you a breaking of a UN gauge theory that I start with to a subgroup, which is the product of these UNI. Near each one of these UNI, this phi is massive. By assumption, I'm assuming they are isolated critical points. So the dynamics of massless modes are just a pure N equals to 1 Yang Mills of this product type. And there's some massive vectors corresponding to these W plus minuses, which have become massive in this vacuum, and some scalars, which these adjoints have become massive. And the dynamics of this, we have a picture. Because this is just a product of N equals to 1, we know what's going to happen, gauge unit condensation should take place, etc. So we have an intuition about what should happen in this language. So in an approximate sense, we know what's going to happen here. So I'll give you another example. A2 case. Well, this is UN1 times UN2 with superpotentials W1 and W2, arbitrary parameters alpha and beta. And I didn't write down the geometry, but you could immediately write down the geometry in terms of mapping this to the T1 and the T2 and the T3 in this geometry. Now, if you try to analyze this theory, you go to the critical points of W. Those are the usual solutions I already talked about, where each one of these UN1s breaks to some number of UNs, N equals to 1. Either this breaks or this breaks. But there is a third branch opening up, which is when you break the UNs to the diagonal UNs, where the Qs are not 0 anymore. In other words, here you remember there's, in addition to this superpotential, there's a phi Q phi. Q phi Q, which corresponds to these matter multiplets. So you have another branch where the corresponding U's break to the diagonal one. And that condition for that to happen is this. So there are three types of branches here. And this actually is not surprising at all. That is just the root lattice of SU3. And in fact, from the identification I gave with the TIs, it should have been immediately obvious that I'm going to get that structure, because the critical points are when the TIs vanish. When the holomorphic P1s vanish, and there are three different types, the three different roots of SU3, we are familiar with this from the A3, from the AD geometry of K3. So already we have three branches, so that should not be surprising. For general ADE, well, it turns out for every positive root of ADE, written in terms of a simple basis of positive simple roots, in terms of some positive coefficients, there's a branch for every solution to this equation. And this, depending on how many of the brains you put in this branch, let me call the number of the brains you put in that branch M of KJ, then you break the original gauge group, UN1 up to UNR, to the product of UMKJ plus some massive fields. So this, again, generically an n equals to 1 structure, it turns out, with some massive fields again. Of course, this is only if these are generic. For non-generic ones, you're going to get more interesting structures. Various massless modes are going to be around, etc. But let me just describe these simple ones for now. Of course, there's a condition, namely the Ni should be in agreement with how many of them I'm splitting in terms of how many of them I need for each particular branch. So they satisfy some relation between the Ni's and which branches I'm choosing. Let us go back to the A1 case. So we have a UN gauge theory with a superpotential. This is the geometry. I just changed some signs here by change of coordinates. So you have this geometry that we have. If I'm assuming W is isolated critical points, it looks like some product of T minus AI. So at each one of the critical points, this looks like a conical geometry. But I warned you that I'm only describing the complex geometry. I'm not describing the Kähler geometry. So indeed, when you are talking about blowing up the Kähler geometry of ADE, as you should do if you want to have a finite coupling, over each one of them, you're on the resolved conical geometry, where you have an S2. The holomorphic volume vanishes, but not the Kähler volume. So I want to distinguish the integral of the holomorphic two form and the Kähler form. There's a finite P1 as far as the area goes at these points, but the holomorphic two form over them vanishes. So we said that you can break the UN to a product of UN1s depending on how you distribute the phis in terms of these eigenvalues. Well, the brain description of this is kind of obvious. You have n total D5 brains, and you can distribute them any way you want in the given class. You can put N1 wrapped around this S2, N2 wrapped around the other one, and you get UN1, UN2, UN3, etc. as expected. So that's just the brain version of the same gauge theory statement, that if you choose the same eigenvalues for phi, you get UN1s. Why is phi identified with this? Well, that's because the normal deformation of phi is that parameter, clearly. So the VEV of phi is precisely which point on the T you're putting the brain on, so that's exactly that map. But recall that near each one of them, you have a conifold-like geometry, which is resolved to a P1, small resolution of the conifold. Okay, I think this is the end of the first part, the construction and the gauge theory analysis of it. Now the large and duals. Well, the large and duals, the five brains should disappear and be replaced by fluxes. Namely, the S2 should shrink, the S2s I was talking about, S3s should grow, and the size of the S3s should be related to the gauge general condensation. What does it mean for S3 to grow? Well, it means that the equation I'm starting with is not the right equation. It should be deformed. So we started with an equation like F equal to 0 like this, which is singular. Namely, there are some singular points. Now you're going under S2 is going to 0 size, and S3 is going to grow. You have to deform it, this equation, to resolve it. And the number of deformations is exactly the number of normalizable, including the log normalizable one, is in one-to-one correspondence with the number of S3s that you are having in this geometry. So you can parameterize any way you want, but in particular, you can choose the coefficients of these monomials to parameterize these n different sizes of S3s. the brains disappear, they're replaced by foxes. So that point, which was doubly degenerate over the T-plane, now is going to split to two and replaced by fox coming out of it, and all of them should be like this, with some fox corresponding to how many brains disappeared over there. Namely, the Ramon fox corresponding to the corresponding S3 should be Ni. Which Ni? Well, depends on which branch you're interested in. You want to study the branch where UN is break into particular UNI, well, you put N1 there, N2, etc., in accordance to which branch you're interested in studying. There's actually one more H flux that you're going to have in the dual cycles corresponding to the bare gauge coupling, which I will explain in a second. Let me first write down the general formula. This gives rise to a superpotential, which is the obtained by a combination of the Ramond and Novo Schwarz three-form fluxes combined in this form into a three-form H wage omega, where omega is the holomorphic three-form of the Calabi-Yau, integrated over the Calabi-Yau. This is something we studied with Taylor and Meyer also independently studied this. The four-fold version of this was also studied before this paper by Gukov and Witten and myself. If you decompose H wage omega in terms of the symplectic basis of cycles in Calabi-Yau, you get this usual formula in terms of H over the A cycles and omega over the B cycles with a minus sign. This is the familiar formula for string theorists, is familiar from the study of Riemann surfaces. The A cycles I take to be these S3s, and the B cycles I take to be the dual cycles, which are non-compact. The intersection of the A and the B cycles is delta ij. The integral of omega over the A cycle is the size of that S3. I call it the size of S3, and I denote it by Si. The integral of omega over the B cycle is determined by the Si's. Why is that? Well, there are as many coefficients in the geometry as Si's. So once I choose these Si's, it will give me a Calabi-Yau geometry. These will be determined. These periods will be computed in terms of these Si. So these dual periods are functions of this S. Very complicated functions of them, but nevertheless, in general, some functions. Now, this is the key here. The fact that Si is identified with trace of W squared. This is the result of all the non-trivial work having to do with topological strings in one box. This is a non-trivial statement that you can actually identify the sizes, not just approximately or some function, but precisely with trace of W squared. The identification that the Gopakumar and I have immediately implies this formula. And if you recall that in the topological string, the linear term is not fixed, this will dictate what it has to be. Namely, if you consider the dual flux of the H in the B direction, if you have a bare term in the gauge theory, which is trace of W squared itself, it tells you what this is. Namely, you identify these alpha I with the bare gauge coupling constant. So we have a superpotential, ni pi I, which is a function of s's, minus alpha I si. And yet we haven't still figured out what this deformation is. Well, how do we figure out the deformation? We have to insist on the supersymmetry preservation, which in this case means dwb 0. So all we do is just plug in dw equal to 0. Pi I is a function of Si, so this is a function of Si. You take derivative with respect to n variables and equations, solve them, find the Si's. What does it depend on? It depends on Ni and alpha and the coefficients of the superpotential. Namely, the coefficient of superpotential appear in the geometry here. So these will have the full information about the gauge theory, and the choice of the branch is encoded in terms of the W. Find the critical points will dictate what these n coefficients, which we didn't know what they are. It will give you precisely what the corresponding gauge theory dual is, the geometry dual is to that gauge theory. Well, we are lucky in this particular example because the integral of that three cycle in general is horrendous, but in this case, essentially the geometry is one-dimensional. So the integral of omega over 3 cycles boils to one-dimensional line integrals. So you get line integrals of the form of w prime squared plus delta of t dt. And that's the kind of thing one has to study. But there is more subtlety. These periods are infinite. In fact, the superpotential I wrote down doesn't really make sense. The dual periods, the omega over the dual periods, do not make sense, as it shouldn't have, because the Baire coupling doesn't make sense. The Baire coupling is, so if you write as 1 over g squared, g goes to 0 at the ultraviolet, so that should go to infinity. So this part doesn't make sense, and these periods also are infinite. These are non-compact cycles. Integrals of this over it diverge. Well, what should happen is we have to cut it off, as usual, but now infrared cutoff. And we identify literally the point on the t-plane where we cut it off with the ultraviolet scale of the gauge theory. This is, of course, the UVIR as an example of a UVIR exchange, but in a very direct fashion here, we just cut off the integral that you want to compute the superpotential for in the infrared. In fact, it's a very non-trivial check, the fact that the lack of divergence can be absorbed into alpha. That's the usual renormalizability of field theory. That's a very non-trivial statement, that you can absorb this divergence into this simple form. That's the running of the Baire coupling constant again. This is, again, a very non-trivial statement, and it's true. You can check that the divergence as lambda goes to infinity is precisely captured in this form if and only if these deformations are up to order t to the n and no higher. So precisely of monomials of the form 1t up to t to the n minus 1, these divergences can be absorbed into redefinition of alpha. In fact, gives you the running of the coupling constant as a function of lambda, not so that this quantity is finite. It gives you a renormalized scale, as usual. So this is a very nice, simple infrared physics description of the running, and in particular, it should agree with the gauge theory analysis, and I will discuss in a second how that works. So now, we are familiar with the Kanefold story. So as I said, these S2s have been blown up to S3, so they're just like a Kanefold story that we are familiar with. We know what the periods are for the Kanefold. They are mu log mu type of things, or S log S type of things. But again, divergent, as I said. But you have to cut it off, regularize it, and in fact, gives you the running, as I explained. So to leading order, if you take these S3s to be small, you get a formula for superpotential which looks like Si log of some parameter, which depends on how the Kanefold looks like near that particular point, divided by Si to some Ni. So this is what you get for the leading computation of the Kanefold periods. And it matches the naive computations of n equals to 1 gauge theory, as I told you. In other words, the un breaks down to the product of uni, and the naive formula, this old work that you were referring to, I guess, Veneziana company, there would have a superpotential there that it looks like this with some cut, with some renormalized scale. The renormalized scale, by gauge theory analysis, is obtained by integrating out massive adjoint fields, as well as integrating out massive vector bosons. And this gives you a matching of scales between the ith gauge theory and the overall scale of the UN theory. This follows from a simple gauge theory analysis, and it agrees directly with the periods that you get for this Calabi as a further check. However, this is just a leading computation from the dual geometry. In fact, from the dual geometry, we get an infinite expansion in the SIs. It doesn't stop, typically. This is OK from the gauge theory analysis. The gauge theory analysis does not claim to have given us it precisely. It just gave a first-order matching computation. This is not forbidden from gauge theory, but it's also not computable directly from it either. So the gauge theory analysis, completing this is not known. We know this is an approximate formula. We don't know how to complete it. But we can compute it from the infrared dual description that I just gave you. So we find from the dual geometry, you get these kind of formulas, plus an infinite expansion. This is familiar from the periods of Calabi. It's very complicated, typically, infinite power expansion. This is what it is. Where these coefficients are non-trivial functions of n's and the coefficient of superpotential, and as I said, are exactly computable. Okay, how do we test it? Well, you look at the critical points of W, gives you the number of vacua. You can check the number of vacua work. Well, that actually can be done already at this level, because the number of vacua is dictated by the leading term. The rest over just shift things, but it doesn't change the number of vacua. So that already matches with what we expected. But we have more data, namely, we can compute the tension of the domain walls going from one vacuum to another. That is the value of W at one critical point relative to the other. That difference is physical. The tension of the BPS tension of the domain walls is a physical statement. That is absolutely well definable, and in whatever way we compute that, it should agree with this computation, if this dual description is correct. So we aim for this. We aim for trying to compute at least this much of the data, namely, the number of vacua as well as the tension of the corresponding BPS domain walls from a gauge tree analysis. This can be done in the gauge tree analysis using the Seiberg-Witten geometry. That's because the setup we are having is very close to an n equal to 2 theory. It's an n equals to 1 with an adjoint. So that's an equal to 2 matter content, plus the deformation by superpotential. Well, but that exactly is natural from the n equal to 2 analysis. In fact, Seiberg and Witten's analysis already used this to fix the corresponding curves and all that by taking quadratic masses and so forth to the adjoint. So here we can just go back to their analysis in the sense of n equal to 2 Yang-Mills and just add the more general superpotential and try to do that analysis. So the corresponding Seiberg-Witten curve in this case is known by a group of authors. I forgot to write their name. And what we're interested in is to find particular loci of these where the appropriate monopoles can condense, so they should be masses. And this corresponds to some degenerate limit of the Riemann surface. So n minus n masses monopoles should exist because you want to confine all of them except for some bunch of U1s left over, n of them. So confining of those U1s means that you have a singularity of that structure, and this must mean that this curve should factorize in this particular way. There would be some loci where this happens, and you have to find the critical points. You have to compute the W as a function of these loci, take the critical point, and compute the W at the minimum. That's what we have to do to compare with this formulation. It would be nice, and it's not known how to do, to directly connect the monopole condensation field with the Gaugino field. It should be morally that. But there is no direct map known in this story, so I cannot use that. But there must be a part of that story which tells you how more precise map is between the monopole condensation field and the Gaugino field, Gaugino bilinear. But since that's not available, all we can do is check the value of the W at the critical points where you have to find the loci of solutions where this factorizes in a particular form. Well, this analysis turns out, unfortunately, to be difficult because finding this kind of loci is not a trivial task at all. And it hasn't been done for general case. So let me give you some examples where it has been done. So take a very simple example. Instead of a most general potential, let's take a cubic potential. So the gradient of W is 2 points. So there are just two types of vacua. So UN can only break to UN1 and UN2. So the breaking of U3N to UN and U2N has been done before. And we also completed this with two other examples, namely U5N to U3N, U2N, and U5N to U4N to UN. It turns out once you have a branching type, you can always put N. N doesn't play a role. You can always find a way to get rid of that N piece. But the branching type of how you break an integer to two different integers up to a common factor is what's non-trivial and what has to be done. And in general, it's not known how to find the corresponding loci. These involve trickery like Chebyshev polynomials and things like that. Well, after all this song and dance, we compute the U3N, which goes to UN times U2N. And one finds the W is given by Ni Si log lambda I over Si plus the other one, which is the naive answer. This was the only answer known before we started this computation. So we were starting this theory with only one example known in the literature, which gave us this answer. And we were banging our head against the wall saying the Calabi-Yau geometry predicts an infinite expansion. Where's the rest? And we were getting this advice in general from Geisters that, well, usually integrating in is exact. For no good reason in this case, it is. That misled us for a while, a bit disappointed, but we continued because we believed in duality in this context, and we found that in the next case it wasn't so simple. So we had to work out one more example at least to convince ourselves that that's not the general story, and this is the only example which looked like this. We have this other example, where if you compute the break from U5n to U3n to U2n, compute the critical points, evaluate W at the critical points, divide by n, the first three terms, where T is some combination of the coefficient of the superpotential in this way, the first three terms will be determined by this type of naive integrating and minimized, evaluated at the minimum. This will give you these kind of three terms. But there's an infinite expansion we get from geometry as well as from the gauge theory, and they match. Well, up to the order we had checked. At least to the order 8. Similarly, U5n works the same way. Again, we get an infinite expansion. So typically, we get infinite expansions. That silly U3 to 2,1 was a silly case, which misled us. But generally, there's an infinite expansion, and it works. Note that the large and dual geometry is much easier to work with because we don't have to do any splitting. I'm giving you the answer right here. It's just ni pi I plus, you can give it to a computer. You don't have to be smart. Just give it to a computer and have it minimize it. So in other words, we have a concrete program for all ni's without anything, without trying to find the loci which minimizes, which gives a singular geometry to the Riemann surface. So it's much simpler. And it does all ni at once for all groups and all splittings. So this, even though it agrees with the Gaussian analysis, this is by far simpler to work with. There is more check one can do. The un breaks to un1 times un2. I should have been precise when I said about the n equals to 1 gauge constant, etc. The sun factors undergo that. There are also these u1s. So you should have two u1s in the story. So you can ask, what about the coupling constant of those u1s in the infrared? And those give you, on the underlying Calabi-Yau, the coupling of the would-be n equal to 2 of that Calabi-Yau. In other words, the SIs I'm talking about, if we did not have fluxes, it would have decomposed in terms of n equals to 1 multiplet to a chiral and a vector multiplet. The vector multiplets is identified with the diagonal with these u1s, and the chiral multiplets is identified with the gauge condensates of the suns combined together, but deformed by fi n equal to 2 superpotential terms, breaking n equal to 2 and n equal to 1. So it's a funny unification of a gauge chiral field with a vector multiplet of n equals to 1 to an almost n equal to 2 supersymmetric theory. Okay. Extensions of it. We can extend this to other large and duals by considering other geometric transitions. For example, we can take n equals to 1 un gauge theory with two adjoint fields, x and y. And in fact, this is related to a geometry, the geometric engineering of it is related to a geometry that was considered by Morrison and Katz again a while back. For purely mathematical reasons, they were studying it. But this is very interesting from gauge theory, because this here, we have no other way of approaching this question. N equals to 1 with two adjoint fields is notoriously difficult to study from any perspective. It's neither near n equals to 1 nor near n equals to 4. This is in the middle. So this one, we have no way to check our results against. Again, the computation formulation is as simple as I told you. We can write down the formula of the superpotential and extremize it. We have no way to check it. So this is a novel gauge theory result, which we have no other way of reproducing. The same large analysis applies to the affine case. So let me move on to the affine case. With this condition I mentioned before, the superpotentials satisfy one linear relation. The Dynkin indices times them is zero. The only modification in the geometry I told you is the interpretation. That's all, nothing else. What I called about role of coupling constant, which is dual to some flux, is related to the free brain charge now because of the relation between the induced free brain charge of Novo Shorts and Ramon fluxes, which are in the dual directions. And the running of alpha naught is a cascading in the case of A1 hat studied by Klebanov and Strassler with W equals to phi squared. So the running I'm talking about is their cascade in that language. One exact correspondence, but more precisely, we can say at which point in complex geometry what is the coupling and how it's changing, and we can map it directly to what is this corresponding free brain is changing. That's a cascade story. Nothing changes in analysis, no single equation changes from what I said. For example, the thing I just told you about A1 with a W can be interpreted as an A1 hat with a W and a minus W for arbitrary W. In fact, as I will discuss in a second, cascading is much more general than the A1 hat with superpotential. It's true for all AD with arbitrary W. But before I do that, I want to take a digression. Are there other dualities related to geometric transitions? Well, the answer is yes. This is another completely, apparently unrelated story. So with Uguri in, I don't remember, 96 or so or something like that, we realized the cyber duality in the context of type 2A by wrapping D6 brain around three cycles of Calabi-Yau. And we found the cyber duality is a transition from a three-cycle geometry to a three-cycle geometry. Just a trivial cycle shift, a three-cycle to a three-cycle, gives cyber duality. This, by chain of duality, was related to the construction of Kutuzov et al., where they have NS and NS prime brains. That mapped to this in the type 2A language. It's geometric transition. Since I'm describing type 2B setup here, let me translate this geometry in a type 2B mirror. In the type 2B mirror, the transitions, that the mirror of what we did with the Uguri, is transition from two cycles to two cycles. This is a work to appear, but it's a natural description of the mirror. But these are wide reflection. Seiberg's duality is wide reflection of the corresponding node. Namely, suppose you have a quiver theory, N1, E1, N2, E2, etc. If you take this E1 and do a wide reflection, an S2 cycle in the AD fiber goes to another S2 cycle, and N1s and N2s and N3s change. How do they change? Well, take, for example, a wide reflection about a node like E1. E1 goes to minus E1. E2 goes to E2 plus E1. E3 goes to E3 plus E1. That's just a wide reflection. But the brain charge cannot change. That's exactly the way we derive the duality with Uguri, just by brain charge conservation. So N1 E1 plus N2 E2 plus N3 E3 should be N1 prime E1 prime plus N2 prime E2 prime plus N3 prime E3 prime. This gives you N1 prime is N2 plus N3 minus N1, and N2 prime is N2, and N3 prime is N3. This is the number of flavors of this gauge group, so NF minus NC, and these don't change. That's cyber duality in this context.
Do you see that they're supposed to follow the same?
Yes. So, this just shows that they're connected, to be more precise. So whether the infrared dynamics shows which one is weak, there's a further analysis one has to do. So this is at the level of connecting them. So S duality for the AD n equals to 1 quiver theories is a wild group of the ADE. That's the S duality group. What about the affine case? The affine case is a wild group of the affine ADE. The wild group of the affine ADE is the wild group tensor semi-Dirac product of the translation of the root lattice. What is that translation? That's cascade. Cascade is a translation part of the affine wild group. I hope that wasn't too fast. Well, this might surprise you in a sense, because we are not in a cyber kind situation. We are actually in an n equals to 1 theory with adjoint matter with superpotential. So we are in the category of Kutuzov-like dualities. So what are we talking about here? Well, I should then be more precise. I should say the cyber-like dualities, not cyber dualities. But the duality that I'm actually talking about has been done, and this is by this group. So the gauge analysis with the adjoint field, which has hypermultiplet or matter multiplet, but coupled with the adjoint field, has a different dual, which looks more like cyber duality. With the same superpotential, gives you another dual field, which is of the same type. So the cascading story was already anticipated here, where they actually constructed the gauge theory with an arbitrary superpotential with some matter field. And if you take Q phi, Q kind of potential, the dual is exactly of the same kind, with some sign changes, flips. With the sign flip, which is E1 to minus E1, which is the Wiley group transformation, obviously. So we predicted this, and actually we didn't know about this work until the prediction we were looking for, and we were directed to this reference. So indeed, the geometry predicted this duality, and it was actually observed also from gauge analysis directly. But you see, we have now a unified picture of all dualities in this context. Cyber-like dualities are transitions of geometry of S2 to S2. Large end dualities are transitions from S2 to S3. So this is the related to the title of my talk, namely dualities as geometric transitions. I hope I've convinced you there's some merit to that. Thanks. Yes? Yes? Yes. So the statement is that the brain charge being negative will be supersymmetry breaking. In other words, the cascade just will say that some brain charge is related to another brain charge construction. Whether they actually flow in the same theory is related to where you would stop the cascade. Here, all I have said is that they are connected to each other. Your question is when do you dualize the theory? In other words, when is the NF in the right regime to dualize and so forth? There's an extra dynamical question which I haven't addressed, which we're currently working out. But you have a choice of doing it, and that's related to that question. Yes. Yes. All n. All n. The point is that there's duality for any n is true. The question is which side is a good side to work on. This is actually a point that I think has been confused at some points. So I would want to emphasize it actually. And even there's some confusion. So I think the viewpoint I have is the following. In any dualities you have, in the large duality, you have the natural Etouffe parameter, which enters the story. And for example, in the ADS-CFT story, when we have these as parameters, we have a natural breaking point where T is much, much bigger than 1, this regime, where let's say we have ADS-type description. When this parameter is small, we have a D-brain description. And the question of which regime you're in, it depends on what you want to choose a parameter. The same theory is true here. Namely, if you're interested in the ultraviolet questions, you'll be pushed on the other side of the transition.
The question was not, the superpotential you get is
linear in N. Yes.
That's a very simple N.
That's an exact statement for all N, if that's what your question is. Yes, that's an exact on all N. And in fact, the Gaussian analysis that we did, even though it looks like a complete function of N after you compute things, is actually consistent with that simple formula. So that's a prediction, actually. So I have set the scale in the theory to be to string scale, and I have just chosen the coupling constant to vary at that scale. That's what I've been calling this other parameter. So I'm just varying that. So there's a relation between those parameters, which is the gauge and condensation relation. So which limit, which side you're on, depends on whether you want to take it big, small, and whatever. So, but if you're interested in the questions of gauge theory, you always inevitably end up with the S3, which is tiny in the string units. So if you're actually trying to decouple it, you have essentially a singular geometry. So the magic here is that we have been able to get exact answers because we are protected by supersymmetry. But if you want to do a string computation, you're going to have to work harder because the string theory perturbation breaks down in the abstract sense when S3 is such a small S3.
I mean,
confused, like, what exactly do you mean by the field theory side when they're replaced by the perturbations of those greater than 3?
Sorry?
What exactly do you mean by the field theory side when they're replaced by the perturbations of my power of 5?
What do you mean in terms of renormalizability, etc.?
Yeah,
you can think of it as an effective theory integrating out some other modes. You can do that always. So this is an effective theory of integrating out, and it doesn't matter what's the underlying theory which gave rise to that for those holomorphic quantities. It's insensitive to that choice. So in any theory which leads out to that effective theory, will give you this answer. So that statement is that's a general statement for whatever theory you start with. In fact, it turns out you can actually construct a limit of these ADE quiver theories which actually give you those potentials. For example, the AN quiver. If you take just linear potentials, quadratic potentials, with a particular limit of it, you get an A1 with an nth order potential. So you can actually realize that more precisely. If you're interested in that, I can explain it.
No more questions, I think, from Morgan again.
Thank you.